Welcome in, everyone, to Redacted on this Tuesday. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris.
She is my lovely wife. She is not my sister. I know you guys like to rag in the chat. They're like, your sister is great. She's not my sister.
We don't even look alike.
That's my lovely wife. We've got a jam-packed show for you on this Tuesday. We're going to look at Putin's invasion force, because a number of reports suggest there are hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers amassing at certain points around the southern region of Ukraine, into possibly Odessa and in the northern regions as well. Will this lead to a massive invasion? This is what, of course, many people have been wondering. When is Putin going to actually launch this? We're going to dive deep into that tonight.
Plus, we are going to talk to a journalist who has actually looked into the Nord Stream pipeline, has some interesting insights about that. Plus, we're going to head to Canada, talk about Justin Trudeau, why he's decided that Muslims can't think for themselves. He needs to tell them what their Quran tells them. That's sensitive. Plus, I have some... I spent the day going through vaccine trials for this new RSV drug that they're going to give... Preemies, what?
How did you spend your day?
Looking through vaccine trials.
Yeah.
The mainstream media is super excited. There's a new shot. You give preemies, babies and preemies, for RSV. Is it safe? They don't give a crap. I'm going to tell you everything that the mainstream media should be telling you, but seems not willing to. They're just excited there's a new thing they can inject your tiny baby with.
Welcome to the clown world. You've tuned into the right show because we try to help you navigate through this crazy clown world. Redacted starts right now.
That's funny, in the chat they're talking about how we kind of do look alike. Like maybe we're one of those old married couples that you start to, and we also look like the dog.
No.
We all start looking like the dog.
We've got a little mini pincher, so we're going to start looking like him. You're going to start to get
pokey face.
Like my giant ears. You're going to get my giant satellite dish ears. These ears are great though, because I can pick up FM stations. Like just walking around. You don't even need like AirPods or anything like that. I can just pick up.
And you'll get
frequencies.
My five head, my big forehead.
So I'll get a big forehead. And you'll get my giant ears. It'll be a weird...
FM is lame. I get satellite.
You get satellite now? You get Sirius XM?
Through your glasses?
Through your glasses.
But yes, but I've been to space, so what can I say?
No, but you're so hooked up with different wires on a regular basis that you probably don't... You can't tell the difference between your own ears and headphones anymore. That's what that's your world. Right. And Philip's the same way. Can't get, you know, he's too hooked up on it.
Yeah.
On that.
I don't even leave my office. I just stay in here 24/7, just pushing buttons. That's what I do.
That's what we do. It's like the guy in the episode of Lost who has to keep pressing the button every 30 minutes to make sure that the silo doesn't blow up. Oh, by the way, have you watching the new show, The Silo? Oh, that show's great. The Silo on Apple TV.
I'm not going to say it's great. I'm watching it with you.
It's good. I'm enjoying it. I'm really enjoying it. It's a really good show. I'm enjoying it. Enjoying the heck out of it.
It's one I want to check out for sure. Yeah.
I've seen the previews
and I'm like, yeah, I think I could get into that.
I have now twice fell asleep during episodes.
That's because you're like, you started at 11 o'clock at night and then you know you can't stay awake past then. Mm-hmm. All right. Enough of that. Hey, we do have a daily newsletter that you should all read because it's free and it kicks ass. And by the way, it's the number one newsletter in the world. I don't know. We actually just got word that Cat Fancy Magazine named our newsletter as the best newsletter in the world. So thank you, Cat Fancy Magazine, for your high endorsement. No, they didn't. But if you go to redacted.inc and you put in your email address, you'll have to verify it. And then you get a great newsletter starting tomorrow morning. Every morning around 6:30, 7 a.m. Eastern time is when we publish the newsletter. And you'll receive it in your inbox. And you can read it in about 5 or 10 minutes. Here's a look at what it looks like. We give you some like news you might have missed in the morning. We give you some market updates. But it's honestly our way to stay connected with you, because these platforms love to censor us and take us off of the platform that we're currently on because of the stuff that we cover here. And in fact, last night we did a story that YouTube decided to censor. So again, we've been blocked and banned before, and our way to stay connected with you is with a newsletter to let you know what's going on, and it's free. And we don't sell your information to anyone. We just give you a great newsletter. So go to redacted.inc and sign up. Again, redacted.inc. Well, a lot of moving pieces in the war in Ukraine. And the Wall Street Journal out with a piece today saying that Ukraine is now adopting what they're calling a slow approach to the counteroffensive. They say their problems are everywhere in the sky, according to the Wall Street Journal. So a slow approach, what exactly does that mean? There are Ukrainian reports that Russia is mounting a large number of forces in multiple spots for perhaps some large-scale offensive. We also are hearing reports that the United States and members of Congress saying the United States needs to go on a war footing against Russia to amp up our ability to produce ammunition because we've sent all of it to Ukraine. For all of that and more, we wanted to bring in former UN weapons inspector, former U.S. Marine Scott Ritter for an analysis of this. Scott, great to see you.
Hey, good to be here.
So let's start with this Wall Street Journal piece, Ukraine adopting a slow approach to the counteroffensive. What exactly does a slow approach mean?
Well, I think what they're talking about is the reality that the approach that the Ukrainians had been preparing for, that is to take armored forces, find a seam in the Russian defenses, and then rapidly exploit these, exploit that to burst through the defenses, get into the rear area of Russia, try and repeat what they did in Kharkiv in September and October of last year, that this has failed. The Russians have put in an impenetrable wall of defense. And so the armored vehicles, as soon as they enter these minefields, are being halted. Artillery is raining down on them and taking them out. So it's an impractical approach, an unsustainable approach. And so what they're doing instead is going old school, and they're taking infantry, and they're basically just pouring infantry into smaller objectives to seize little bite-sized pieces, and then just keep pushing forward. They call it the slow approach, but it's basically an extraordinarily bloody approach. It's an approach, again, that isn't going to work, because even though they are successful with this tactic, because the Russians aren't in the business of dying. I mean, there's a lot of Russians dying, but the Russians aren't willing to sacrifice, an entire company of soldiers to hold a village at all costs. So if the Ukrainians decide we're going to move forward and take this particular tactical objective, and they're going to put artillery in, and they're going to push the troops in, regardless of the cost, what the Russians do is they absorb that attack, then they withdraw to new positions in the rear. The Ukrainians will take their objective, and then the Russians will hit that with artillery and then launch their own counterattack and push the Ukrainians out. Now, sometimes Ukrainians are able to bring in more infantry and hold on to this village, and that's considered to be a victory. But again, it's an unsustainable victory. This is what they mean by the slow approach. Somebody was commenting on this approach and basically said that if this is the approach that Ukraine is taking to reach the Sea of Azov, it's going to take them years to get there, and they're going to run out of men. So the slow approach is just spinning that Ukraine has failed in their counteroffensive and has no chance at all of succeeding.
Throwing them into the meat grinder, essentially, is what's happening. And we're seeing continued reports from a number of Ukrainian soldiers who are now coming forward and telling the truth about how they were commissioned or brought into the military. I just want to play one example. This is a Ukrainian soldier. I guess you could call him that. He was sitting on a park bench with a degenerative spinal condition awaiting to get medical care when he was approached. And he tells the story of this is very, very common being brought into the military. Listen.
Сидів на скам'яйці, підійшли з воєнкомату парні, спитали, чи я стою на обліку на воєнкоматі. Я сказав, не знаю. Вони тоді взяли мене паспорт і сказали, садись в машину. Я садився в машину, відвезли мене на воєнкомат. Медкомісію я не проходив. Я прийшов в больницю, хотів пройти медкомісію, вони самі все пройшли за мене. У мене проблеми з позвоночником. А когда забирали, я говорил, что у меня проблемы с позвоночником, они меня не хотели слушать и проверять. ну, подготовка в Великобритании была плохая, бо я как-то строчку не служил, а там проходили подготовку один месяц. И...
So, Scott, we've seen multiple reports like this, where disabled individuals, mentally handicapped individuals, people with degenerative spinal conditions are being rounded up, people not wanting to leave their homes for fear of being rounded up and thrown into this meat grinder.
Well, I mean, look, the Ukrainians have a problem. They're running out of men. The army that they had, and remember, they started this conflict with a regular army of 260,000, another 300,000 trained reserves, and another 700,000 territorials. That's, you know, again, simple Marine math, 1.2 million people capable of being put under arms. They're gone. They're gone.
Wow.
And so what they have to do is get more people out there. They're running out of qualified, you know, manpower, healthy manpower. First of all, the other thing is Ukraine is so corrupt. If you pay the military commissar the fee, you won't get rounded up. So the people they're rounding up are the people that aren't paying the bribes. And those people tend to be, you know, a lot of them are the younger ones are smart. They'll just hide. They don't get cut. So the people left are the guys who think, I have nothing to fear. I'm crippled. I got a bum knee. I'm old. I got a degenerative spinal condition. You know, things of that nature. And it doesn't matter because they aren't looking for healthy, you know, fit, manpower. They're looking for bodies. They need bodies to throw into this meat grinder because it's a process of trying to wear the Russians down. And so you're just throwing body after body after body. And understand, these aren't well-trained soldiers either. They're getting minimal training, and then they're being thrown into this horrific situation. And the casualties are mind-boggling. I bring this up to everybody who says, we need to support the Ukrainians. We need to give them more. We need to do this. All you're doing is condemning hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian men to die. Ukraine cannot win this war. There's no zero scenario that can be written right now that has Ukraine winning this war for any number of reasons, but number one of which is they have run out of trained manpower. War is a complicated business. In addition to being a bloody business, it's a complicated business. If you're going up against a well-trained enemy, and the Russians are well-trained, understand that principles of maneuver come into play, that you have to be skilled in knowing, you know, how to suppress an enemy position, how to maneuver, how to coordinate, how to call in artillery. It takes years to train people to do this. And when you get two armies of similar training up against each other, then what happens is they wear each other down until somebody gets an advantage that can be exploited. At that point in time, the wise enemy withdraws from the battlefield to regroup, to start over again. The Ukrainians can't even get into this fight. This isn't even a Pop Warner team trying to play an NFL team. This is basically a bunch of third graders who should be playing touch football or flag football, walking into the Super Bowl, challenging the defending Super Bowl champions. There is no chance whatsoever for these guys to win. And this is the reality. There's nothing we can do. No weapon system we can provide. No amount of artillery shells we can provide. No amount of money we can throw into this problem. The Ukrainians cannot win. They have crossed that critical threshold where they can't recover from the losses that they've sustained. And this is the reality of this conflict.
Yesterday on Fox and Friends, you saw mainstream media talking about this idea that we're out of ammunition. We've sent so much of ammunition and weapons to Ukraine that the United States can't even restock its own supplies. It would take many, many years. But I want to play a clip of this because I think that there's a sentiment among some members of Congress that we need to take a war footing against Russia, that we need to really ramp up our military production in order to take on Russia. Listen.
So they've looked at exactly how long it's going to take to restock our munitions. When it comes to the 155 caliber shells, it's going to take between 4 and 7 years to replace it. That's a long time. They are estimating that the javelins we have given to Zelensky will take 8 years to replace. And the Stinger missiles that we've shipped a trillion of them over there, This is jaw-dropping. They say it will take 18 years to replace them. So, you know, when the president reveals we're out of stuff, we're out of a lot of stuff.
But there's a couple of things that add to that. That's if we do the current way we're doing it. We have to adjust the way we're doing it. And we got to get into almost a wartime footing.
So, Scott, that's what we need to do is have a war footing in military production. What exactly is he talking about? Is that to go up against Russia, China?
Well, first of all, it's to survive. If I'm in the military, remember, my job in the military is to prepare for any potential conflict scenario that the United States might realistically run into. And we have contingency plans that we make up. Whether it's if China invades Taiwan and we get involved in a fight there, if North Korea comes across the border, we get in a fight there. If Russia decides to push in on the Baltics or Poland and we get in a fight there. If Iran does something, we have to get in a fight there. Every one of these has a contingency plan that has forces allocated to that. And those forces have to have resources allocated to them capable of dealing with the problem set. And these are all complicated problem sets. And what we're also learning is that we haven't imagined the right war. We've been building our support packages based upon old thinking that placed precision over massed fires, meaning that we needed less artillery. That's okay. But as long as we could put precision fires down on the enemy, we don't have a lot of artillery shells. Well, we're learning in Ukraine that that's just a flawed premise. Ukraine is firing between 5,000 and 7,000 artillery rounds a day. We currently produce 85,000 rounds a year.
Wow.
Thank you very much for that look, because that's what's going on. So Ukraine will fire what we produce in a year in less than a month. And so what we've been doing to sustain them is stripping our stocks that are used to back up these various contingency plans. And what the Pentagon's not going to tell you, and what the president's not going to tell you, is that if we go to war today, we can't win a single conflict. You want to know why? We have no ammunition. Want to know why? Because we gave it to the Ukrainians. Now, we have some ammunition, but the ammunition that we have generals saying, okay, we need to retain a minimal amount of stocks to meet a contingency. But those contingencies, we're learning, are based on flawed assumptions, on artillery expenditure rates that are unrealistic. In the Gulf War, which is one of the conflicts, you know, America's always accused, and there's brilliant writers who talk about this, we always train based upon the last war. And the last big war we fought was the Gulf War, 1991. We fired 60,000 artillery rounds for the entire war, 60,000. And that was considered to be a pretty, you know, we were pumping out rounds. We were doing okay. Russia fires 60,000 rounds in one day in this conflict. Do you understand the scope and scale that we're talking about? We aren't ready for this conflict. So even when we gave Ukraine ammunition, we said, well, we're going to keep enough to meet our contingency requirements. But now the generals are going in and recalculating, saying, we made a mistake, because the ammunition that we have right now that's supposed to last for a conflict that can extend 3-4 months, we're going to run out of ammunition in 7 days. And then we got nothing, zero. And this is going to be for any conflict we get involved in, any, not just Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, anything. If we get involved in a major fight, we're going to lose because we have no ammunition. And this is why they're saying we need to go on a wartime footing, because what we're trying to do right now this isn't just about Ukraine. This is a serious national defense problem. We need to start producing ammunition. I'll give you again, the Russians, they're producing, I think, 3.2 million rounds a year. We produce 85,000. Do you understand what I'm saying? The Russians have geared it up, and they're gearing up even more. They're going to produce even more because the Russians understand what's going on. The Russians have built an army that's expanded from 900,000 to 1.5 million because of NATO expansion. They're in the process of putting a 70,000 man strong core sized unit in the St. Petersburg area, a new military district to oppose Finland. And what Russia is doing as they build this up, they have to produce the artillery that's on hand, because when you go to war, it's not about what you can produce. It's about what you have right now. We don't have anything. We have nothing. Russia's meanwhile stocking everything up. So Finland needs to understand that if they ever get in a shooting match with Russia, once that corps comes up, Finland's going to run out of ammunition. And in modern warfare, when you run out of artillery ammunition, you lost the war. It's over. This is the reality right now. So that's why they're saying we have, and it's not just artillery, as they pointed out, the Javelin missiles. We emptied our stocks, poured everything in there. We got nothing left. I mean, we've got enough, but again, it was based upon flawed assumptions about how much we're going to expend. We now understand that we're going to fire more Javelins in a day than we had prepared for the entire campaign. Same thing with Stingers. We haven't been producing Stingers because we haven't been fighting anybody that has an Air Force. So when you look at a defense budget, it's like, why do we need to buy new Stingers? Why do we need to keep a Stinger production line up and running? We're not fighting anybody. We have some on hand. If we get in a fight with somebody with the Air Force, we have enough to get by. Now we realize that if we have to go up against the Russians and they bring the drones in, the drones swarm in, and we need the Stingers to take out, we don't have them, which means early on in any conflict with Russia, they're immediately going to seize control of the airspace over our forces, and they're going to hammer us with kamikaze drones. To give you another example of how Russia's gone on a war footing and we haven't. They started this conflict with a drone called the Lancet 3. It's a loiter drone. It's a very effective weapon. They fire it off. It loiters over the battlefield, has an optic system, finds a target, hits the target, kills the target. But these drones were made in small batches. The Russians now have gone into full-scale production. Right now, they can produce 200,000 of these drones a year. They're getting ready to scale that up to 2 million a year. And they're building a new drone that they've updated during the war, learning lessons, and they're going to hit us what they call the swarm of drone approach. Basically, when you watch these shows where they release the drones and they at nighttime and all the lights come on and the drones turn into a running man and all that because they're talking to each other. Now imagine if you take that technology, throw 200 drones over the battlefield that are communicating with each other, and they come over the battlefield and you can't shoot them down because you don't have any Stinger missiles anymore. So they get to loiter over the battle any way they want, talking to each other. They pick 200 targets, coordinate amongst each other, and bam, they kill everything at once. That's the future of war. We're going to lose, Clayton. We're going to lose like you've never seen loss before. This is what's happening to the Ukrainians right now. The Russians have learned every lesson there is to learn about modern conflict, and they've adapted it because they have geared up their defense industry on a wartime footing. And they are producing things in the quantities necessary to sustain conflict against a peer-level enemy in a large-scale ground combat scenario in Europe, and they're improving their technology. These drones are a game changer if you don't have air defense, and we don't have air defense.
I just got chills thinking about that. It's unbelievable. And I guess this is why, and I'll get you out of here on this, Scott, which is the Ukrainian defense minister has called for the abolition of the constitutional norm prohibiting the deployment of foreign military bases in the country, essentially making it available now that in Ukraine they would allow foreign military bases, i.e., I guess, NATO bases in Ukraine. And we hear reports of Russia amassing forces in the north, as well as near Odessa, for a large-scale attack. What do you make of that piece of it, the military bases and this large-scale Russian attack?
Look, Ukraine is desperate right now. They understand what's happening. They understand that they've lost and that the only way that they can change this is if NATO directly intervenes. And so they're trying to create in a situation. It's not just about the bases. You have Zelensky working with President Duda of Poland to talk about erasing the border between Poland and Western Ukraine, creating some sort of union, political union that would allow Polish troops to come in and all this stuff. At the Vilnius summit that just took place, the NATO summit, the United States and others threw cold water on that because it's Jake Sullivan, who I don't like very much, but he said, any scenario that talks about creating a potential for direct conflict between the United States and Russia is talking about World War III, talking about the end of the world, and we're just not going to even entertain that discussion. John Kirby did the same thing when they said, why don't we challenge the Russians in the Black Sea? Why don't we, because of this, the end of the grain deal, why don't we send U.S. Navy ships and escort these grain ships out? And Kirby said, because that'll put us in direct conflict with the Russians. That's World War III. We're not going to do it. So Ukraine really wants the world to commit suicide in order to save Ukraine. That's what we're talking about. Now, about the troop buildups, I've been saying this all along, and so have most people who follow the war in Ukraine. You know, when Russia mobilized the 300,000, they sent about 80,000 to 100,000 of those 300,000 to the front to fill in units that had been under strength, undermanned. In addition to those 300,000 that were mobilized, another 150 to 200,000 volunteers were brought in. And these volunteer units likewise have been fed into the front line. But what no one's talking about is around 200,000 Russian soldiers that were mobilized and were taken away to be trained, to be organized into offensive-minded organizations, given the most modern equipment, the most detailed training. They've been training nonstop. They got mobilized in October. They've been training since November. It's now July. They've been training really hard. And their job is to wait until Ukraine has wasted its offensive capability, wasted its primary remaining military capabilities, which they're doing right now. And then once Ukraine is punch drunk, punched out, has no fight left into them, counterattack. And so what we're seeing right now is in the north towards Kharkov, about 100,000 Russians from these reserves being brought in, and they're going to begin the process of pushing the Ukrainians back. They're going to begin the process of doing what Vladimir Putin spoke of. He said, we will recapture all of Russia's territory. Remember, Russia views Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk and Lugansk to be Russia. And so any Ukrainian troops that are on the territory of those are, from the Russian perspective, on Russian soil. We will recapture all of Russia, he said, and then we will push the Ukrainians back to the distance of the longest range of the weapons provided by NATO so that Ukraine can never again strike Russian soil, which means they have to be pushed back 150 kilometers. That's what these 200,000 troops are going to do. So Ukraine mobilized 60,000 troops to train for this counteroffensive. Already over 20,000 of them are dead. The other 40,000 are going to die. That when that happens, their best trained troops are gone. They still have some units that are capable, but now we're talking about 1,000 miles of frontage. These guys can't be everywhere. The Russians are bringing in 200,000 troops. Some rumors are that another 100,000 are being massed in the Kherson region. Why? Odessa. Kharkov, Odessa, two Russian cities that are probably going to be occupied by Russia sometime by the end of summer, early fall, when I believe the Ukrainian army will collapse because you can no longer sustain combat. You become combat ineffective. We talked earlier about the training necessary to maneuver, to put down fire, to coordinate. When you lose that ability, all you have is raw meat, and raw meat just gets ground up. Ukrainians are coming to the point where all they have is raw meat, and there will be a general collapse of the Ukrainian army. And when that happens, the Russians have 200,000 fresh troops ready to exploit that. And I think we're seeing the transition into this final phase of the conflict.
I think you're absolutely right about it. Scott Ritter, great to see you. As always, thank you for your analysis, and we will keep an eye on this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, well, Scott. It's always great to have his perspective, chilling, though it may be, at least I do feel like it's very realistic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even if you, don't agree with him, you don't have to agree with him or not. I mean, the sources and information that this man has from having been a former UN weapons inspector and a former Marine, who the connections that he has and the sources that he has, it's, you know, even if he's 70% accurate on his analysis, it's completely damning and harrowing.
But his track record on our show, at the very least, if we were to rewind the last year, is higher than 70%. And I have to admit, a lot of times the things he was saying, I was like, I don't want to hear that.
And then
but
it's true.
He's right. Yeah. So I'd rather have heard it than not have heard it. Yeah. I'd rather none of this be necessary, but we're not at peace.
Well, when you have 100,000, 120,000 amassing near Odessa, we're going to see. And we've been saying on the show for a year now or longer that if they take Odessa, and one thing, you know, that I talked about offline with Scott before is the idea that, if they hitting this Crimean bridge was one of the biggest mistakes they could have made. Hitting the bridge could have been the absolute biggest mistake for Odessa specifically because If they now move on Odessa, where they want to making sure that their safety is shored up, to be able to protect themselves, then you have a landlocked country with no seaport. And that's, we've been saying for months. I mean, Colonel McGregor said it on our show as well. If they take Odessa, it's game over for Ukraine as a country. It will become a landlocked garrison state, basically, is what it will become.
Right. And it accomplished nothing, even if it succeeded in breaking that bridge altogether. There still, it was pointless.
So coming up, we've got an independent journalist here on this Nord Stream discovery, new revelations on what was behind the Nord Stream bombing, who was behind it, what new evidence has emerged. We've got independent journalist Jeffrey Brodsky, who just testified in front of the United Nations on this very topic, one of the only independent journalists that we know of that's gone to all four blast sites of the Nord Stream pipeline, is going to be joining us here on this show. So thank you guys for subscribing, because you're helping to support independent journalists with this show. We do not make money from Pfizer. We don't make money from billionaires. And we support independent journalists who are bootstrapping and who need your support. Otherwise, we don't get any of this information, because then we end up having to rely on, you know, garbage like CNN and the BBC and these types of things. So thank you guys for subscribing to this channel and being a part of our live show every night at 4 p.m. Eastern time.
All right. We are going to also talk about Justin Trudeau, how he is telling Muslim people what they think. That's always super helpful and enlightened. And then we're going to go out over some, it's not a vaccine, the new RSV shot that they want to give small babies. No mainstream media is asking about the clinical trials and adverse events. It's shocking. I watched my Twitter feed about this. ABC, CNN, CBS, they all did stories about this new shot for babies for RSV. Not one of them asked about the clinical trials and adverse events. Not one. Not stinking one. Well, I have them for you. I read them. I don't think they're awesome. I would love it if you follow along with this segment. We're going to do that in a couple of blocks. And tell me if I got it wrong. Tell me if the calculation of risk to benefit is better than I am thinking it is. I really want to know what you think. Okay. But first, we're going to tell you about our friends over at Indeed. The thing about running your own business is every single hire counts. And no hiring partner understands that like Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. So don't spend hours on multiple job sites looking for a candidate with the right skills, not knowing if they're going to match your company culture. You can do it all with Indeed. Find top talent fast with Indeed's suite of powerful hiring tools like Indeed Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews. And if you hate waiting, don't worry about that. Indeed's U.S. data shows over 80% of Indeed employers find a quality candidate whose resume on Indeed matches their job description the moment they sponsor a job. And especially for us here, we have such a small team. We work so closely together. We really need to make sure that anyone who comes in to work with us in any way, is aligned with our culture, understands maybe Clayton's sense of humor. Not everybody does.
It's a great sense of humor. It's hilarious.
It doesn't always translate. Sometimes it's lost in translation. Actually.
We could all aspire to your level of humor.
No. Just kidding. That's me. It's me whose jokes sometimes come off as creepy. So if you want to make sure that you've got someone who understands you, someone who fits into your company culture, you need to check out Indeed. Indeed knows when you're growing your business, you need to make every dollar count. And that's why with Indeed, you only pay for quality applications that match your must-have job requirements. Indeed knows hiring needs to be cost-effective when you're running your own business. And they know that when you're doing everything for your company, you cannot afford to overspend on hiring. So visit Indeed.com/redacted to start hiring right now. Once again, that's Indeed.com/redacted. Indeed.com/redacted. Terms and conditions apply. Cost per application pricing not available for everyone. If you need to hire, you need Indeed.
Well, why won't the international community investigate the bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline, the largest ecological disaster, the largest ecological attack in world history? Seems like a good idea, maybe, to get some answers on that. They don't seem to really care about that. Tucker Carlson asked that question to presidential candidate Nikki Haley over the weekend, and she didn't have any kind of answer. Watch.
Well, speaking of energy in the military, who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline?
I mean, I don't know.
I'm not claiming you did it. No. I'm just kidding. No, I don't know. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Do you know who did it?
Seems pretty obvious. It was backed by the Biden administration, I would say. I mean, I think all the evidence suggests that, but I wasn't there. I guess what I'm really saying is, if you were running against the Biden administration, to do something like that and shaft our closest allies in the world, which would be Western Europe, and deprive them of the energy they need to run their manufacturing sector and destroy their economy, which it is in the process of doing, like, that's a major sin to have done something like that. You just betrayed our allies, and no one on the right is accusing the Bidens of what they clearly did. So I don't know why.
My next guest, though, is asking that question. Jeffrey Brodsky is a journalist who just testified before the United Nations. Watch.
Thank you very much. My name is Jeffrey Brodsky. I'm the only journalist to travel to all four blast sites of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines on the Baltic Sea. I've been investigating the Nord Stream sabotage since the day it occurred on September 26, 2022. I appear before the United Nations Security Council on my own behalf. I represent no government or organization in the testimony that I will deliver. The attack of the Nord Stream pipelines is likely the most severe act of eco-terrorism and the largest instance of industrial sabotage in history.
And Jeffrey joins us now to talk about his investigation and looking into the Nord Stream pipeline. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Clayton. Pleasure to be here.
So why did you start investigating this?
I was, when this took place on September 26, 2022, when the sabotage occurred, I was just fascinated by it. And I was a little bit taken aback, frankly, that it didn't seem like the mainstream media in particular was interested in asking any hard questions or really investigating the sabotage. And I read as much about it as I possibly could. I talked to some politicians, mainly European politicians. I talked to some experts, researchers and scholars, and I learned as much about the sabotage as I possibly could. And then when I did, when I felt that I had enough knowledge, I started contacting some editors of magazines and newspapers, and they were interested in what I was saying. And then I became, really investigating even more deeply and more thoroughly into what happened, into the sabotage.
To dive even more deeply into this, you testified before the United Nations, bringing to their attention some things that you found. You're one of the only journalists, to my knowledge, that's gone to all four of the different sites. What did you find? How did you locate these sites, and what did you find when you got there?
Okay, so I think I am the only journalist to go to all four blast sites. They're not difficult to locate. Anyone can, you know, geo-coordinates, longitude, latitude, they can be located quite easily. We had a sonar device on our boat, we chartered a boat, and the captain and his first mate were very knowledgeable. These people they do a lot of expeditions on the Baltic Sea, and it was quite easy for them to locate all four of the blast sites. As to what we found, what was most significant that we found was the purpose of our expedition was really three things. We wanted to, one, determine the amount of explosives used at each blast site in the attack. We wanted in kilograms. We wanted to figure out where the explosives were placed, where the bombs were placed. Were they placed on the pipeline, under the pipeline, next to the pipeline? And we wanted to figure out what type of charges were used. Were these linear shaped charges? Were these bulk explosives? Were these canonical charges? And we were able to do that by capturing underwater drone images and videos that had never been seen by the public before of all four blast sites. And we were able to do that by also capturing sonar images of all four blast sites. I then took this data that was obtained through the expedition, and I showed it to explosive experts, ex-US Navy SEALs, the managing director of an explosive engineering company. And for the first time, they were able to calculate accurately the amount of explosives used in the attack at all four of the blast sites, for example. That was really significant because before it had been reported previously, and erroneously, I should say, that it was up to, for example, about 500 kilograms of explosives used at each site, or even more. But those calculations were inaccurate, and they were just far overestimated. These experts that I talked to and have quoted in my articles, they've said that it's between 10 and 50 kilograms per blast site.
Why is that significant? Can you educate us?
Yeah, why is that significant? Well, it's significant because, you know, knowing the amount of explosives used is one of the clues to how the operation was carried out, how it could have been carried out, what was used to carry out the operation.
Perhaps the size of the boat?
Size of the boat, certainly. Whether or not, you know, divers went, whether or not a submarine would have been needed, perhaps what kind of UUV would have been required. And, you know, that would indicate that, you know, a smaller boat could have been possibly used. And it also indicates that divers were likely used. A submarine was probably not involved, or it may have been, but, you know, a diver could have done this certainly without the assistance of a submarine, according to the experts I've spoken to. So that was all significant. You know, those were significant findings and clues that could really lead to, you know, hopefully at some point unmasking a perpetrator.
So fewer than 500 kilograms of explosive used at these four different blast sites.
Vastly fewer. 10 to 50, and 50 would be the very high range. Most of the experts I've spoken to said it's, you know, closer to the 50 figure than the 10, than the 10 figure.
So what was the United Nations response when you presented this data to them?
Well, the United Nations response was, unfortunately, what its response has been, you know, since this took place, you know, approximately 8 months ago. It seems that that all the countries and security councils kind of fell back to their previous positions, which is that there is saying that there is an ongoing investigation. I should say there are three ongoing investigations they've been conducted by Sweden, Germany, and Denmark, separate investigations. And they keep saying, well, we should just wait for these results. But, you know, it's very unlikely, at least according to the experts I've spoken to, and at least what we know about, you know, underwater surveillance systems, that these countries, at least Sweden in particular, doesn't know what happened. And the U.S. doesn't know what happened. And it seems to me that these countries are dragging their feet. And, you know, when $26 billion of critical infrastructure is blown up, infrastructure that was critical to the European economy, particularly the German economy, which is often called the motor of the European Union, is sabotaged, it seems to me that the public has a right to know who did this and how it happened. And it's in the public interest to know. And I'm not really sure why there isn't consensus in the UN Security Council about this.
What surprised you the most, apart from this, maybe the size of the explosives? Was there anything that stood out to you that maybe contradicted some of the reporting we've seen from Seymour Hersh and others that point fingers specifically at the United
Nations? I'm not sure if Seymour Hersh's reporting has been outright contradicted, but, you know, he did mention in an interview, maybe two interviews, I'm not really sure, that there was probably two bombs used on each pipeline. It looks like there was just one bomb used on each pipeline. And it looks like, but on the other hand, there are some things in his reporting that, you know, seem to be corroborated, that there were probably divers used.
And do we know from whom, which country, who was involved? I mean, again, what Seymour Hersh has said is one thing, and there now it seems to be the United States and the mainstream media in the United States is trying to push the blame off on some rogue Ukrainians within Ukrainian security service that no longer alive. So it's an easy scapegoat. What does your research show you about that? Able to confirm or deny any of that?
It's not able to confirm or deny any of that, but there's some open source research that can, you know, that indicates that the United States and its allies, particularly the United States and Sweden, know who did this. And I'm just going to, you know, kind of quote, there was an article, a wonderful article by James Bamford in The Nation, and he talks about something called what he calls a little known and highly secretive integrated undersea surveillance system This is a surveillance system that was built by the U.S. With Sweden's help, ironically. And what it is these are kind of arrays of acoustic sensors that are tethered to the seafloor. And what the surveillance system does is it can analyze distinct engine sounds. So if you have, you know, whether it's aircraft or whether it's a sea vessel, whether it's subsea or a surface vessel, you can turn off your transponder. There's also ways for, you know, satellite not to detect you, but it's really tough to turn off your engine and go anywhere. So just by unsophisticatedly call it the purr of the engine, you can identify and actually fingerprint, as James Bamford says in his piece, you can fingerprint the vessel. So if these vessels can be fingerprinted, the question is, why hasn't the U.S. said anything about these vessels? Why haven't they made these vessels public?
Well, Jeffrey, you know, of course, the Baltic Sea, I mean, it's incredibly remote. No one can go there. Maybe a few penguins. It's so far removed from civilization. Of course, I'm being sarcastic here. The Baltic Sea is a major thoroughfare. And can anything happen in the Baltic Sea that we don't know about?
Well, you know, Clayton, as I mentioned earlier, I interviewed a lot of people on the record and off the record. And one of the MPs, European MPs, a German MP that I interviewed, I asked him basically that same question. Is it possible that we still don't know? And I should say this MP also, I believe he sits on intelligence committees. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, but I quoted him exactly in my United Nations remarks, that he said something like to me, you know, Jeffrey, this is the most highly monitored and trafficked body of water on the planet. This is the Baltic Sea. This is not Mars. How is it possible that a massive, you know, terrorist attack like this takes place in the middle of the Baltic Sea? And everyone's, you know, and now I'm speaking, not him, everyone throws up their arms and says, you know, we're stumped. We don't know.
It's remarkable.
Doesn't seem to add up.
Yeah, there's a lot that doesn't add up here. One piece I'll just kind of get you out of here on this point, and it's come to light in the past few days with this attack in Crimea over the bridge over the past 24 hours, that the BBC reports, well, the Ukrainians contacted us, and yes, it was the Ukrainian Navy along with the Ukrainian Security Service that carried out this attack, and they're very proud of this attack, right? So this Ukrainian Navy, where does this Ukrainian Navy pop up from out of? Because we've heard, when the attack on the Nord Stream, well, Ukraine doesn't have a navy anymore. It's been destroyed. But now the Ukraine has a navy suddenly? So there's this back and forth debate about, well, where's Ukraine getting this navy all of a sudden? Anything come to light in your research about that, the Ukrainian navy piece of this, and what type of ship might have been used?
Not what type of ship can be used, but, you know, there is, again, some open source things on there, or now it's open source. You know, the Discord leaks, you probably remember, I think it was quoted in the Washington Post. Zelensky is quoted as saying, that they should maybe blow up other pipelines, other Russian pipelines. And, I should also say, you asked me, Clayton, about, you know, why was it so significant to go to all four blast sites? The BBC chartered an expedition to one of the blast sites in October of 2022. So just a month after the sabotage occurred. They made a big mistake. They actually only went to one of the blast sites, and it's almost 100% accurate to say they did not even find an actual blast site. What they did is they found a 250 meter long rupture in the pipeline, if I remember correctly. And this, when you have a 250 meter long rupture, you can't determine where was the bomb placed, how many explosives and kilograms were used. You can't really draw any significant conclusions. Experts can draw significant conclusions. So, and furthermore, the BBC, what they found was a large rupture in the pipeline. In other words, just a large hole. But the rupture was actually not caused by a bomb or the explosions. The rupture was caused by the overpressure of gas, the rapid release of the gas due to the bomb in a separate area of the pipeline. So what was really significant is we went to Nord Stream 2 Line A in the Swedish exclusive Swedish economic zone. And that is, you know, the depressurized site. This line was blown up twice. And the site we went to was blown up approximately 17 hours after the first explosions. And therefore, when you show images and pictures, or picture images and videos to experts of this site, you're able to, they were able to make accurate conclusions, draw accurate conclusions about the amount of charges, the placement of the charges, and the type of charges. That's what's really significant. And it was curious to me, you know, why the BBC, and I think there was a later expedition just last month in June by Danish TV to a public television station. And it was curious to me why they didn't go to the, you know, the depressurized site. Why didn't they go to Line A, Nord Stream 2 in the Swedish zone? Because that's really the site that can provide clues and insight into how the sabotage was carried out.
Convenient omission, which is exactly what the media is excellent at. Jeffrey Brodsky, we look forward to your continued reporting on this. We'd love to have you back on the show as you uncover more about this story, which I think is one of the most important stories of our time, the bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline. Thank you so much for this. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Clayton.
Yeah, thanks, Jeffrey. And we should mention, we'll have a link when we publish this video to Jeffrey's Substack. I would encourage, again, it's so important to support independent journalists like Jeffrey who are, you know, bootstrapping this, being able to go out into the, you know, into the ocean, into the Baltic Sea, be able to go to these different blast sites.
Yeah.
And to be able to bring this information to the United Nations. You know, like our own Dan Cohen, who is now a member of our team here at Redacted. His coverage of Haiti, for crying out loud, is what led to hearings at the United Nations, right? This actually matters. Independent journalists actually matter. So please support independent journalists like Jeffrey and David Creighton and the other journalists whom we have on the show. It really, really important. So thank you guys all for subscribing, because if you subscribe, it's free to the show, and it really helps get these messages out there that mainstream media blocks, bans, censors, and hides.
So, yes, like Disu right there, who just subscribed, and you get your name on the screen.
Yeah, if you subscribe, you welcome to the rebellion. If you subscribe, your name will pop up here on the big screen. So thank you, Disu. Appreciate it.
All right, I'm excited about the next few stories. Excited, not like, oh, I'm happy about it. Excited, like I'm worked up about it.
And that we're going to shed light on it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to tell you about how Justin Trudeau feels the need to tell Muslim people how they think and feel about gender. Maybe next he can take on the fact that they pray in single-sex spaces. That would be sensitive. How about that?
Tyrannical Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, because he believes in, you know, telling
protests,
people how they feel.
I mean, the protests are popping up all over Canada now against him, saying, keep your hands off our children. Keep your hands off our children. Go Canadians. Way to go. People should take to the streets. Go out there. Join these groups that are showing up at these government buildings and telling them, keep your hands off our children with your, stop pushing this ideology on our children anymore. So good for Canada for taking the lead on this. Maybe we can all learn from them, like what they did with the trucker convoys. And the rest of the world was like, holy shit. Yeah. We need to stand up. So way to go, Canada.
Right. Some gumption there. I like it. Also, we're going to go over the clinical data that is given to us in the AstraZeneca new injectable. It's not a vaccine. They're calling it a therapeutic that you give to small babies, as in preemies that are born after 25 weeks of pregnancy up to 24 months. So these are the teeniest guys. They didn't ever really approve the COVID vaccine for that population, but don't worry, we're going to make it up with this one. I'm going to show you the clinical trial that no media is asking about. They should have. They lack curiosity about, oh, that, the Nord Stream pipeline, all kinds of stuff, whether or not puberty blockers actually, these are all the questions that you're not supposed to ask. So we're here to ask them and answer them. That is all coming up. But first,
are you an investor looking for an easier way to trade stocks? And would you like 16 free stocks? Of course you would. Who wouldn't want 16 free stocks? Even if you do nothing else with the account right now, you just open it, you make your initial deposits, and then you can watch these stocks grow and you don't have to do anything else with them. Or if you want to trade like I do and invest in some different commodity stocks, oil, gas, different precious metals companies, and as part of my portfolio, you can do that as well inside of the app, the Moomoo app. So right now, our friends over at Moomoo are giving away 16 free stocks when you open your account and make your initial deposits until, coming up here very, very soon, the deadline on this. And even if you never do anything else with the account, you get to keep those free stocks. Moomoo has zero commission trades, and the app looks amazing on every platform from iOS to Android, to Windows and Mac. Moomoo can help you trade with its advanced tools like their stock screener, their earnings calendar. No matter what your skill level is, you'll find fantastic tools that can help you trade. Open your free Moomoo account today. Get access to zero commission trades, 16 free stocks. You just need to use this link to get those 16 free stocks. You need to go to redacted.inc/Moomoo. That's redacted.inc/Moomoo. They've been one of our longest supporters of our show. So when you support them, you help support our show and you get 16 free stocks. Yes, that's right. You're going to get a Google stock or a Tesla stock for free when you open up this account and make your initial deposits. Go to redacted.inc/Moomoo. Well, Muslims all over Canada have come forward in protest against Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government, calling on the government to, quote, leave our kids alone, keep gender ideology off our kids. Justin Trudeau claimed on Wednesday that Muslim parents who are against their children being brainwashed by LGBTQ ideology in schools are just victims of misinformation and disinformation from the far right and from the American right wing. That's right. So it reminded us of this piece from former White House spokesperson Jen Psaki, of course, who now works at MSNBC. She echoed this sentiment that Muslims are being controlled by the right of the by the right in this gender critical movement. Listen.
So lately, I've been noticing the reemergence of a very old GOP playbook. The right wing is reviving that same playbook, this time with Muslim Americans and trans people. Hear me out here. The GOP is trying to recruit Muslim Americans, a community that makes up less than 2% of the U.S. population, against another tiny marginalized group of Americans, transgender people.
Well, journalist David Creighton, who's just covering the story, has written a piece in the Post-Millennial about this, all these protests that are emerging across Canada as these protests grow. And David joins us now. David, good to see you. So it appears that Trudeau thinks Muslims, I guess, can't think for themselves.
No, he really believes, or he is attempting to make himself believe, that Muslims are, as you said, the victims of some broad U.S. conspiracy. And that's, it answered my question, because when Muslims across Canada, especially here in Ottawa, and Calgary has been a hot center as well for Muslim protests, I asked myself, how is Justin Trudeau going to address this? Because if he attacks the Muslims, it's going to be Islamophobia.
Right.
And yet he can't allow Muslims to attack the gay pride season, as Justin Trudeau calls it. So the question was, does homophobia trump Islamophobia? That's the conundrum Justin Trudeau had. Because when Canada has become a nation, a collectivist nation of identity politics, where every different segmentation has special status and special rights. We're no longer equal under the law, which is where this country originated and where it must go back to. But in Justin Trudeau's Canada, everybody has special status, except, of course, evangelical Christians, who are the most vilified people in Trudeau's planet.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's an interesting dichotomy, isn't it? That why can't the left seemingly cross Muslims? Like, that's an off-limits thing. We absolutely cannot. No, it's you're brainwashed by the far right. Like, as a Muslim, you're being brainwashed. You are, you know, you're sacrosanct. But Christians, they're fine. They're fine to vilify Christians. Why is that?
They're fine to vilify Christians.
It's a big question. You know,
unfortunately,
of course,
because evangelical Christians have not fought back to the degree that they have traditionally in the United States against this left-wing upheaval. And I think I'm damn proud of what these Muslims have done in this country, because they have taken up the slack from other religious groups, including conservative Catholics, who should be out there as well in great numbers, saying, we don't stand for this. We don't think 13-year-olds should be seeing pornography in their schools or being told they have a right to change their identity, their gender identity, without even telling their parents. And really, Trudeau has gone so far with this LGBTQ ridiculous alphabet soup agenda that people, common sense people of all faiths, are saying this rainbow flag doesn't represent anything except hatred against our values, because there are a lot of people who still question this sexual fetishism that LGBTQ month is selling people. It's no longer just about tolerance or acceptance of gay people. It's about acceptance and promotion of a huge variety of sexual fetishes and a huge distinction that children can suddenly be treated as adults. And what I fear this is going to, if we allow children to say, I have a right to change my identity at 13 and not tell my parents, and my parents have no say in this, then they can be treated as adults. And that is the broad opening to pedophilia being accepted and legalized. That's where this is going.
Well, we already see the infiltration, of course, by MAPS and others. We see how the rainbow flag went from, you know, gay and lesbian. Suddenly now it's infiltrated with the trans rights activism. So now you've got this new crescent chevron shape that's now encroached on the flag. How many more things can you cram into this flag? It'd be interesting to try to figure out. But why do you think that they ignore the very tenets of Islam, right? That's the question here. So he's sitting there talking with these parents, and the parents are saying, no, this is Islam. Like, it's very gendered. Islam is very gendered. And like, you can't, it's like, you know, you can't ride in cars or pray with the opposite sex. It's a very gendered religion. And so it's almost as if they're ignoring that part of it.
Well, it's interesting because it gets back to Trudeau's basic creed, which essentially is a socialist Marxist creed. He believes Muslims have a false consciousness, in the old Marxist phrase, the same way that working class people used to support conservative parties and not socialist parties because they just didn't buy into the ideology. He's saying, what's wrong with these Muslims? They should be thinking like me, because Justin Trudeau is a Catholic and he has had an audience with the Pope. And yet Justin Trudeau cannot abort babies fast enough in this country. Mm. We have literally abortion on demand up to the last trimester.
And suicide on
Justin
demand.
Justin Trudeau thinks that's okay.
And now so, suicide on demand in
and suicide in on demand.
Yeah.
And the school system is becoming completely obsessed, as it is in the United States. It's becoming completely obsessed, not with teaching children things that are going to enrich their lives and help them become adults. It's teaching them a variety of sexual habits, which have no place in the school system. These are things that the parents have got to be regulating. And Trudeau says that's a far right concept as well, that parents should have any right to do that.
I love that they're leaning on this far right idea that they can't think for themselves. And so Trudeau has done this repeatedly with people, that they're being infiltrated by the far right in America, this ideology. This is why you're setting up this freedom convoy, because you're being infiltrated by the far right, by white supremacists who are taking over. That's who's influencing these people. Why are they speaking for them? Why is the Trudeau government speaking for Muslims instead of listening to them? I mean, they're literally in protest standing there telling them, keep your hands off our children. It could not be plainer, right? It's not an ambiguous statement. Keep your hands off our children.
Yes, and of course, Trudeau appointed an Islamophobia czar. This is what's so ironic about this, because he sees Muslims as victims. Most Muslims don't see themselves as victims at all. They see themselves as regular human beings working in Canadian society alongside their neighbors. They don't see themselves as victims. Trudeau sees Muslims as victims, and he wants to keep them in a victim box, because that fits in with his identity politics. If he can victimize people and segment our society and put one group of people, one race of people, one religious group against another, the identity politics works for the Liberal Party. But it's collapsing right now. And this is the crucial matter here, is that Trudeau's identity politics is demonstrating how hollow it is, that you cannot put people in an ideological box and say, you have to vote Liberal because we're the only party that really stands up for your rights. Because the Liberal Party cannot define rights for anybody. Individuals have to define what their rights are and who they want to vote for. And that's called basic democracy. And that's something Justin Trudeau simply doesn't believe in. He believes in forcing his views on other people and telling them how they should vote. And this is, you know, for a while, you didn't hear the usual U.S. style from the Liberal Party. because they were liking the U.S. style of Joe Biden. They think that's great, the way Joe Biden's going. So now it's gone. It's not U.S. style is not the code word anymore. It's American right wing. It's MAGA Trump. It's U.S. Christians. It's the far right. So it's the vocabulary has changed, but it's the same thing. It's the same idea of pointing to this foreign enemy that's somehow telling people in this country how they should think. This is an insult, not just to Muslims, but to everybody, to a lot of the conservative Catholics who don't like Justin Trudeau either, because he says they've got a false consciousness. They shouldn't be thinking and voting as they do.
Wouldn't be surprised how many members of the White House, the Democratic Party in the United States, are helping out their Canadian friends to the north with Zoom calls and conference calls to help them get on the same language messaging. I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised at all. David Craden, thank you so much. We'll link up the article, your most recent piece in Postmillennial, keeping an eye on Justin Trudeau and speaking for the Muslim population. I would love to hear from the Muslims who are watching our show right now. Let me know in the comments below, what do you think of Justin Trudeau in Canada, our Canadian viewers up there? David, great to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Clayton.
Thanks. And Alex here in our chat says, yes, Clayton, Trudeau, the tyrant, needs to leave those kids alone. Yes. I mean, great for these Muslims who are going out and protesting and standing right in the face of Justin Trudeau and saying, no, we think for ourselves. We just don't want you touching our children. We don't want you pushing this LGBTQ plus blah, 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 blah ideology on our children in schools.
What I love about it, though, is that it shows how much more people have in common than are divided. Mm-hmm. Whereas the left is the party of division and telling you that, you know, you don't know how to be sensitive to Muslim people. You don't know how to be sensitive to Black people. If you are in those populations, other people don't understand you. You have nothing in common. Don't worry. The left is the Mary Poppins to, like, pat you all on the head and make sure you're safe in your own little corners.
Yeah,
they don't want you
to
like, yeah, be a united front. And what we're realizing is that most people, we have more in common than we think. And one thing is protecting our children, not hypersexualizing the entire planet, those kind of things. I find it very encouraging to find more common ground.
I was speaking with a friend in Canada today who was telling me, starting first grade school, for his little girl, and was just telling me that went to the school and couldn't believe that they were saying, when we introduce our children, we tell them that they are going to, they're non-binary. So he's like, here's my daughter starting school. They're like, no. Your daughter is not a daughter. Your daughter at this school is a they, them. And then they discover what their gender is.
That's incredibly condescending to the child.
Yeah, my daughter knows that she's a girl.
Right.
What the hell are you talking about? Like, what is happening in this clown world? So, yeah, that's what's happening.
I mean, beyond the fact that that's an agenda push, that also is very condescending to a child who knows what they are and saying, you don't know yet, so we're going to put you in this neutral category until you figure it out,
yeah.
Right? Most kids know pretty early what their gender is and know, like, find comfort in that. Yeah, go ahead.
And unfortunately, what's happening now is if they stand up against that, they'll be kicked out of school.
Right.
The child. Yeah.
Yeah, or the parent will be labeled a bigot for standing up for their own child's gender. Like, oh my God. We need to fight this stuff, guys. We need to fight this stuff. All right. Well, we've got more news to get to here on your Tuesday. We're going to talk about Big Pharma and AstraZeneca. Yeah, what they've got planned for your babies. That's the plan. We're not talking about Pfizer this time. It's AstraZeneca. And you won't believe.
Oh, Pfizer has something coming for your babies. Don't you worry about that. Particularly, they want to vaccinate pregnant moms, even though their vaccine has a high rate of neonatal deaths. But yes, they're coming. Pfizer is coming for the babies. AstraZeneca just beat them to the FDA approval. It's not a full approval, but we're going to get to that. The media would not look it up. Just go on Twitter and look up RSV, and you'll see all the mainstream media who fell in line today telling you how great it is that there's now this treatment for small babies. And then please do stay with me while I show you the clinical trials. And then you decide if that is proportionate to how you want to feel about this. I'm not telling you how to feel about it. I'm going to give you the data and I want you to read it for yourself. But first, before we do that, we want to tell you about Four Patriots, because in a startling description, the UN food chief warned that the world and warned the world with the words knocking on famine's door. He called what we're facing a perfect storm of a perfect storm. And he's not alone. Barron's published a piece that said that a food shortage could be coming even in the U.S. and farmers see it too. John Boyd Jr. is a fourth generation farmer, and he told Fox News, "We're going to see empty food shelves in the coming months. We have seen it in modern times. It's not unimaginable. That's why getting survival food is more important than ever now, so you can create your own stockpile of the best selling products at Four Patriots Survival Food Kits. It's not ordinary food. We're talking about food that's good for 25 years. It's super survival food. And me, I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area. It's always important to have a survival stock because of earthquake preparedness. So whatever there is in your area, whether it's the risk of famine or just having these boxes for emergency preparedness, whether it's tornadoes, floods, what have you, you never know when you'll be stuck for a certain amount of time.
Look what happened on the East Coast of the United States. I mean, all of the storms, the flooding, and all of, you know, all of the people that were disrupted and weren't able to get food.
Yeah, we were taught, you know, to always have an earthquake preparedness with at least 25, you know, at least a year or two of food that does not spoil, and water as well. So you can get a kit so you don't have to shop for it. I've done just shopping for it, like, despair, like, oh, I'll go to Costco, I'll get this. And that's very stressful and anxiety causing. So you can get kits instead. They have different delicious breakfasts, lunches, and dinners. And you can make these meals in less than 20 minutes by just adding boiling water, simmer, and serve. And right now, for the next few days, listeners of Redacted will get 10% off their first order at fourpatriots.com by using the code REDACTED. Once again, you go to four, that's the digit four, and then the word patriots. .com and use our code REDACTED to start your stockpile today. It's just good sense to be prepared. All right, well, the FDA approved a shot for RSV, that's respiratory syncytial virus, for infants now born during RSV season and babies up to 24 months who remain vulnerable to RSV. This is not a vaccine, but it's a shot. They do give you an injection. They give babies. This is approved for babies. Here's the FDA announcement today saying they're super excited about it. Now, they link to the news about it plus the clinical trials. So I took it upon myself to read those. Was it tested? Is it safe? Well, I don't think these are awesome results. I'm going to take you through it. You decide for yourself if these are awesome results. I think some of them are shocking, and you know, these are so-called clinical trials. You decide. It's so interesting that the mainstream media today was just promoting this like a commercial.
That was my thought. Here's your Twitter account. It's like they're promoting a new movie that's coming out. They're like, we're at the FDA. We're proud to announce a new drug from a biopharmaceutical company that we make money off
as
of.
As if, Clayton, as if they might make money.
Yeah, imagine that.
From pharmaceutical companies. They are totally incurious about the clinical trials, but I wasn't. So I'm on this one, you guys. I'm going to show you these, and I want to let you decide for yourself, but I want to let you know that I am a mom who had a baby that did have RSV. I brought a picture of my little Ava Bean. She is now 11. But in this picture, she was 7 months old and she did have RSV. And it is serious. You can see how they had to monitor her oxygen levels with that little thing on her toe because she was so tiny. It's dangerous for babies because it inflates their little air passages that are already too small, like a little coffee straw. So it can severely restrict oxygen levels, and that is very dangerous. So had I known that I would have a baby with RSV, would I have given her this? Well, let's look. The shot is called Beyfortus. It's made by AstraZeneca and Sanofi. It was given fast track designation for this approval, meaning it was expedited and accelerated and never had to finish clinical trials. It had three, but they didn't have to keep going because they decided to just fast track it. Why? Well, they're saying RSV is an emerging and serious need, and babies were filling hospitals with RSV last year. We're going to look at the fatality rate in a second so you can do your calculations. Now, again, the mainstream media is all in on celebrating this injection with headlines like this. Provides lasting protection now, long-acting drug to protect babies and toddlers against RSV. I don't know how they can say that because the study did not prove long acting. I'm going to show you in a second. Again, it's a therapeutic, and they're saying this is a great win for babies. What they're saying is that it reduces the risk of RSV by about 70%. Now, what they mean is that of the groups that they gave it to, placebo versus this shot, 70% fewer of the babies in the shot group were contracted RSV than those in the placebo group. They don't actually know how many of those babies were exposed. It's not like all of them, you know, some of them got the shot and they all exposed them to RSV. You can't do that in a clinical trial. That would be unethical. And we don't know how much were these little babies out in the world. Like, did some of them go to daycare? Some of them are preemies, and, you know, preemies are typically kept inside more often. How much we don't know. We only know that fewer babies in the vaccinated group were actually diagnosed with RSV. Says nothing about whether or not it was serious and whether or not it made their RSV less. They only measure contraction. Okay, so if 70% of the groups in the vaccinated or shot given group were not diagnosed with RSV, if you were 70% less likely, you still are 30% to get it. And if you get it, there's no guarantee that this lessens your exposure to it. Now let's look at these. They said they did three clinical trials. They linked to them, so let's look at them. The first one they did on premature babies, preemies, born between 29 and 35 weeks, and this was done in 2016. And look, this is what they're saying is the incidence rate, is that the placebo group was about 484, and 46 of them, or 9.5% of them, got RSV versus 25 in the group given this medication out of 965. So they're saying that makes it 70% less of the babies in the placebo group, or 70% less, sorry, in the group that got it. Now, worrying though is...
Someone in our chat, Wolf Lone, says, hell no.
Okay.
Hell no.
Okay. Now, worrying is this number of what they call TEAE or TESAE. That means that there's a condition that the baby had as a baseline that worsened after they got this shot. So maybe you're thinking, well, my child already has some kind of lung condition, so I really don't want to give them RSV or have them contract it. So then I would try to give them these antibodies. Well, look at this number. The TAEs, or this baseline thing that the kids had, got worse in both cases, the placebo and the group that got the study. So they're about 86% likely to have this worsening of a condition with or without the shot. But there's more in the TESAE, which is the group that, again, it became so serious that it was treatment emergent that they think it could have been linked to the vaccine. So these are kids that were already sick and got worse. More of them got worse in the group that got the shot. So this is, again, how would you feel if you have a baby who may already be sick and you say, well, this could lower their chance of getting RSV, but it also gives you an 86% likelihood that whatever they have gets worse. I don't think I would take that bet.
Yeah, would you take that trade-off?
And now look at the adverse events. This is total adverse events. So 16% adverse events in the placebo group. That's a weird number, right? But why is something happening there otherwise with these babies versus 11%? But then if you look at the actual incidence, go all the way down to the bottom where it says death. Well, there's one death in the vaccinated group or the shot given group versus zero in the placebo group. And then if you look up at cardiac arrest, cardiac failure, those have at least one baby in those places for the shot given group versus the placebo group. So again, at least one baby died compared to no babies in the placebo group, and three of them had heart attacks or heart failures. Would these babies have otherwise died of RSV? We don't know. So this is a calculation that you're going to have to make as a parent if you have all the data. No, they're not going to give you all the data. At least the news wouldn't. Now, about those two other clinical trials. The second one was done on babies born after 35 weeks of pregnancy. And here's what they say about this number, is that 5% of infants who had this drug received, you know, contracted RSV versus 5% without it versus 1.2% who contracted it with it. Then they say that means a 75% effectivity rate. But I cannot compare this to adverse events, because when you go to this clinical trial and ask to look at the results, this is what you get.
No results posted.
So I can't tell you if babies died or had heart attacks. I literally cannot, because it's not there. Third study, same thing. This one they gave to preterm infants or infants with chronic lung disease or congenital heart disease all the way up to 24 months. Again, we can't compare the adverse events, because same thing on this. Take a look at this clinical trial. No results posted. So the FDA feels comfortable giving us these 70 to 80% effectivity rates with only one data set published from clinical trials, two others posted, but results not given.
People in the chat, Jim Danielson says, thank you, Natalie, for reading all of this trial info. Yes. And then others are wondering, you know, because I had the same question as I was going through this today, too, is what was the placebo? What are they giving them, like a sugar pill, like a saline pill? Like, what exactly was the placebo?
I don't know. And you have to think tiny, tiny babies that are getting an injection.
Well, someone
says
here, Squirrely says, surely there can't be a placebo effect in a baby.
That's a really good point that I had not thought about.
What is the placebo effect in a preemie?
Well, how can you have a death in a placebo test?
They did not have a death in the placebo.
But they had adverse events.
I think you said 16.
There was that huge adverse events. Right?
No, that was adverse events. That was totality, including things like a fever or this, I don't know what this is, inguinal hernia or diarrhea, which, like, who knows?
Right. So just in total.
In total, 16%. But the death was in the drug given group.
But then they won't post the actual. Were there any more deaths, because that data has been withheld? Or,
well, again, this is one of three clinical trials, and two of them have no results available.
And how long until we see that they want to hide this data for 75 years?
Yeah, right. Now, I want to address the question of, how likely is your child really to die of RSV? Or how dangerous is RSV? Because, is this risk worth it? Because if you were to say, like, okay, if the child gets RSV and they're a tiny baby, again, this is something I have gone through myself. What's a survivability rate? If it were like survivability rate is like 20%, then I might take a chance on a vaccine like this with these numbers, right? But as far as we know, the most recent study about the severity of RSV and death rate for children under 5 found that only 2 otherwise healthy children died of RSV out of 42 studies. So this paper examines 42 studies. That means each study had hundreds of kids and found only 2 who were otherwise healthy had died of RSV, because a lot of times otherwise healthy children do pretty okay with RSV. They just do have to be hospitalized if they're small, because inflamed airways means that their oxygen levels are low and they need to go on oxygen, like my daughter did for a few days. It wasn't even something they could treat with an antibiotic. They just helped her breathe until she got better on her own. Now, 2 babies out of 42 studies is 2 babies too many. But clearly, that's a very, very low death rate of RSV. Considering that babies who will take this shot still can get RSV and have a high rate of adverse events and worsening conditions, does that seem like a good trade-off to you, with a very, very low death rate and a high incidence of whatever they've got getting worse? Let me know if I'm reading this wrong. Now, CBS...
Well, can I...
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I just want to say really quick how unfortunate it is that we can't get real data from these companies, because now what it does is if they do have something that actually works, we're not going to know if they're manipulating it, because the pharmaceutical industries usually pay for these studies. And so we found that they're able to easily hide things. So it's like, like any of this data, because of the stuff that we've learned, how do we know it's ever going to be correct? And then if they do have something that's great, how do we know that it actually is? Like, it's very unfortunate that we have to sift through this and try to make sense of it, because they won't.
Right. And consider that the FDA often allows them to remove people that are inconvenient from their clinical trials. So we know that even this not awesome data is what I really don't want to lead you on this, but I'm not enthused by these clinical trials, are probably not even the full story.
Kevin Robb says in the chat, sorry, there's a bug flying through here. Kevin Robb in the chat wants to know if, the two that died, did they get the drug or not?
No, because I'm pretty sure they didn't. The study that I showed you was only on the severity of RSV before there was this treatment. So the two that died did not. And Bad Daddy in the chat asks, why would a parent enroll their kid for a clinical trial when they're like a preemie? I think it's probably because these children are already immunocompromised with some kind of heart failure or something like this. And you think, well, God, I don't want them to get that as well.
They go to these like parents that are, you know, vulnerable, right?
Right. And they say, well, I really can't, you know, have them have this. So let's do what we can and roll the dice. I mean, yeah. I think people who
exactly
have
what,
serious.
Like what you're saying, then when they do that, you finally get a little ounce of hope. And then if you have adverse reactions, they remove you from it and just drop you and don't even help you, and you don't get assistance or anything.
Right. So if you're like immunocompromised, right, you're immunocompromised, you're part of this control group. And so you're getting this placebo effect, right? That's where you're getting these.
All babies who cannot even say what their adverse, like one of them said stomach ache. And I was like, how do you know a child under 6 months has stomach ache? You know, they can't really tell you that specifically. So I'm curious about that. Now, CBS did a report on this, and Dr. Celine Gounder, we've talked about her before. She's the wife of the guy who dropped dead at the World Cup. Remember her? But she still has been very pro-COVID vaccine. Now, she did a piece on this. She says that this is useful if the mom does not get the RSV vaccine. So what the heck is she talking about? Because there is no approved vaccine for RSV for pregnant women, because Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline both are doing clinical trials of an RSV vaccine for pregnant women, and they showed between 5% and 7% risk of preterm births and neonatal deaths. So that's pretty high, I want to say. I wouldn't take something, you know, when I was pregnant that had a 5% to 7% risk of neonatal death for RSV, which I'm pretty sure I could get over. That Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline vaccine has not been approved because they had to stop some of those trials because of this. But she's still saying that will come along, but until it does, we can vaccinate the babies since the moms are not being vaccinated. She does not, in this piece, address the side effects or adverse reactions or death. Of course she doesn't.
But if a born baby has them, then a pregnant woman, it have the same effect, would it not? Because the baby's still getting it regardless if it's in or out of the womb.
Yes, she's saying that the idea of the Pfizer vaccine is that if you give it to the mom, then the baby will be protected. But since we don't have that, we have this now new AstraZeneca drug we can give. It's not a vaccine that we can give the babies, because we can't vaccinate those moms yet because they keep dying in our clinical trials. So until they stop, then that will be the way we'll go, is giving the pregnant mommies. Now, finally, the FDA in their announcement of this does give us this warning that Beyfortus should not be given to infants and children with a history of serious hypersensitivity to Beyfortus active ingredients. These are infants. How do you know that they have a reaction to these active ingredients? Presumably they have not been allergy tested. They're small babies. You don't know that yet. Also, these warnings about hypersensitivity, You know, anaphylaxis, which I don't know if I'm saying anaphylaxis, yes, which been observed with other of these monoclonal antibodies, and should be given to caution to infants and children with clinically significant bleeding disorders. Again, these are small humans who are new here. You probably don't know if they have, reactions to these things. So that's not a very helpful warning. Go ahead, Philip.
I was just going to, along with what you're saying, like, these are brand new people. They don't have a history yet. Like,
right.
It's like they're beginning to write that part of their life.
Yeah. That's the dumbest effing warning I've ever seen in my life. Like, this is for preemies, but you should know their medical history.
Yeah. It's a long track record. Served in Vietnam. Buck or Bill here in the chat says, so you're saying there were just three babies in these clinical trials that were fast-tracked? Three babies that were fast-tracked?
What? No.
Bucker Bill says
I'm
that.
Saying the there were just... What? No.
Okay.
Don't make me repeat. There were three clinical trials, one of which we have data for, and it was fast-tracked. No, there were a lot more babies in these clinical trials. The question underneath was the children used for these trials in the USA or other countries... a lot of them were abroad.
So, Brian Keith specifically asked, were the children used for these trials in the USA or were the children in other countries like Africa or continents like Africa?
Yes.
They use, of course, Bill Gates loves African children for that purpose. So, of course, wouldn't be surprised. We'll finish up. You don't have to be derailed by that. But I just...
That's pretty much it. The idea that, like, there's no medical history of allergies for small babies for the most part. That's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. I don't understand why the mainstream media is like super excited about this. You know,
well,
not asking questions.
Are you really asking that question? Are you really asking that question? I mean, we know that all of these channels, we know that all of these networks are brought to you by Pfizer. Our next segment is brought to you by AstraZeneca. Of course. So they're going to do these segments and promote the hell out of this shit. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong.
No, and we even covered, like, we played a clip of two ladies that were launching the other vax to kids, and they were laughing and, like, celebrating it on air. Remember that?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were celebrating, like, yeah, that was the one CNN anchor. She was super excited about it, right? I mean, she's like...
Oh, yeah. Am I smiling?
Like, she's like, am I smiling? I'm so excited. My babies get to get this stuff injected into their bodies, their tiny bodies that we're going to give this stuff to.
Okay, here it is. These trials were done in Estonia, Argentina, Belgium, Brazil, Bulgaria, Lithuania, Latvia, New Zealand... It doesn't seem like they are concentrated in Africa.
Well, that's a first. That's an improvement. All future vaccines will be tested
Korea,
in Ukraine.
Panama, New Zealand, Spain, South Africa.
We haven't got the other two tests. Like, you know, that
no, these are, so I at be. Least have that much from the other two tests. yeah. Japan, Italy, Hungary. No, actually not concentrated in Africa, all over the world. So. Hmm.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's good. Hey, we should mention to all of you that we have a store. We haven't talked about this in a while, and I wanted to talk to our team because I'd love to get some of our new designs up and running here. I know we were working on some new designs. I was looking for my silence equals complicity shirt today. I was going to wear it and I couldn't find it and I was pissed, and it was a limited run t-shirt from our redactedstore.com. If you'd like to support independent journalism, you can do that by just going over there. We really try to keep these items at cost, very, very close to cost. So very, very close to that. Just you can help support us a little bit there, but we don't jack up the prices on these at all, what it costs to produce here. So if you'd like to get a redacted hat, a mug, tumbler, the sweatshirts are very, very comfortable. That's my dog walking hat right there. That's my favorite gray dog walking hat that I wear every day. You can pick up some of that merch right there at redactedstore.com. I saw a gentleman the other day. I was walking the dog and he said, "Clayton, Redacted?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, love the show.
You got to go around in uniform more often.
Yeah. Actually, You know, the reason I brought that up is because I wasn't wearing my redacted hat that day. And I should have been.
Yeah.
Then I would have been like, oh, it was the hat. You know, he doesn't recognize my giant ears. No, anyway, go to redactedstore.com and check it out. Redactedstore.com if you'd like to support what we do here. So thank you guys so much. I would love, maybe we could get some redacted coffee or something, or redacted...
like the coffee beans.
Hey, I've been working on that for like months.
I know. So. We were testing a whole bunch of different beans and to making, like, wanted them to be excellent.
It's been nuts.
Yeah, yeah. Do we have a pepper spray grenades? Penguin Shoes in the chat says, does Redacted have pepper spray grenades? No, we don't have pepper spray grenades just yet. It is something we're working on at the Redacted store.
Yeah,
I'm still holding out for the Redacted whiskey.
Okay.
Ooh, with your own whiskey brand.
That'd be nice.
All right.
Game for that.
I mean, I could do some honey, but probably not enough to sell on the internet.
Redacted honey.
Because I have bees.
I was just in Scotland when I took the kids to this camp, and I was there for, people were like, where were you, Clayton? Were you at the Tour de France? Do I look like a guy who races in the Tour de France?
Or wants to stand around and watch it?
No, I would have been the spectator who inadvertently caused the massive accident by like wandering across the street, not knowing there was a race
with their
going
coffee.
On. Like, hey, I've got my giant coffee, my redacted coffee. Oops, I just tripped 30 bicyclists. What's going on here? It's the Tour de France, you idiot. Oh, but I went to, we did a little whiskey distillery tour, not the kids. The kids were at camp. I went with a bunch of friends and, it was really nice. But it takes a long time. So for us to have a redacted whiskey brand, it would take like 18 years.
Okay. So hold for that.
Yeah. We're going to get started. And in 20 years, we'll have our first vintage.
Well, my honey's ready now, but I'm not going to sell it.
Well, that means we got to wrap the show up then, if you know what I mean.
That's not a...
Oh, okay. Thank you guys so much for joining us here on Redacted. We really appreciate you subscribing and being a part of this great community here, seeking the truth, because we don't have all the answers, but we're seeking the truth together. We'll be back here tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern time. So be sure to subscribe, turn on that little bell notification dingus so that you'll be notified when we go live on Rumble, on YouTube, on Twitter. And have a great night, everyone. I got to go check my honey. Bye.
Bye.